Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. I have a great lineup of guests for us to talk to today. We'll be hearing from some folks at the School of Management. They have a new faculty member who's going to kick off an emphasis in take over the emphasis in human resources management out there. So, the people who are behind this fundraising effort that involves bicycling across the United States to get money for Africa's Ikerewa School are here. John Bennett will come in to talk about the need for foster families, and we'll be talking to the force behind the Bellingham Alternative Library. So all of that's coming up on Juneau Afternoon. Stay tuned. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Three law enforcement officials from South Carolina have been sent to Oklahoma over the adoption of baby Veronica. KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports on the latest.
Charleston County Sheriff Al Cannon says he sent two deputies and a state agent to Oklahoma as the dispute over the adoption of a Cherokee girl continues. He told the Post and Courier newspaper of Charleston, South Carolina, he sent the officers Thursday because he thought they could assist authorities in Oklahoma. Matt and Melanie Capobianco, who live near Charleston, have been trying to adopt 3-year-old Veronica. A South Carolina court has awarded them custody of the girl, but Veronica's birth father, Dustin Brown, is a member of the Cherokee Nation and is fighting the decision. He says custody should go to him under the Indian Child Welfare Act, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled earlier this summer that federal law did not apply in this case. Sheriff Cannon says there have been no major developments in the case and would not say if any new court hearings have been scheduled. A gag order restricts attorneys and their clients involved in the dispute from talking to the media. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney in Oklahoma City.
A member of the Standing Rock Nation is disappointed she did not speak at the 50th anniversary event to commemorate the March on Washington, but her words are still being shared. Elena Eagleshield traveled to the nation's capital to join others to talk about civil rights. She kept her tribal community in North Dakota in mind.
Just like I let my people down. You know, people were waiting to have someone that they knew that they could relate to that was of their own people up there speaking, and that's why I really felt sad and disappointed.
The mother of two and pre-med senior at the University of Mary says the speech she prepared for Wednesday addressed the struggles of her ancestors and highlighted language and culture. She recorded her prepared speech for the Children's Defense Fund, and it's posted online. Here are some of her words.
As an Indigenous person, I believe that we've always been prosperous, but in a completely different aspect that's not related to material wealth. Mija, wo yu humble wa bluha. Me too, I have a dream that my people will be given equal opportunities to advance in every aspect of their life, but most importantly, that they carry on their sacred languages and their culture. Thank you.
The King Center sponsored Eagle Shield's trip. National Native News reached out to the King Center about the speech being cut out of the program, but did not get a statement by deadline. The National Indian Health Board wrapped up its 30th annual conference this week in Traverse City, Michigan. National Indian Health Board Chairperson Kathy Abramson says much discussion was about advocating and educating lawmakers about the federal government's trust responsibility to tribes.
We're not getting free services. It's not entitlement. The federal government, they promised to give us health, education, and social services in perpetuity in exchange for our land.
Other topics included Medicare, health care reform, and policy. An Oklahoma tribe is celebrating its national holiday starting today. KGOU's Susan Shannon has more.
The Cherokee National Homecoming Fair began in 1952, and it commemorates the signing of the 1839 Cherokee Constitution. The 3-day gathering features a powwow, rodeo, and other events. Principal Chief Bill John Baker will give a speech. Baker says there are some new additions to the fair this year.
We're going to do the ribbon cutting of the brand new Veteran Center that we're going to present to not only the Cherokee veterans, but to all veterans, a place that's just for them. And this year we've got a special treat. We have a Cherokee citizen that has written a musical play about my great-great-great-great-grandmother, Nana He, the beloved woman of the Cherokee, will be playing at Northeastern State University every night of the holiday.
100,000 visitors are expected in Tahlequah this weekend, the capital of the Cherokee Nation. For National Native News, I'm Susan Shannon.
During this month in 2012, a tribal office opened on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming to register sex offenders. The office was established under the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act to close reporting gaps among states, territories, and in Indian country. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
About 5 minutes and 40 seconds after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, hosting Juneau Afternoon today. Take a quick look at the weather here. The weather forecast has the word rain in it for today, tonight, Saturday night, and Sunday. Sunday night, it says mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. And then guess what it says about Monday, Labor Day? It says it doesn't have the word rain in it. I like that concept. I like the idea of maybe a three-day weekend with a day without rain. That'd be really nice. Finish up the garden, a couple of things like that. Anyway, Dr. Charla Brown is here with John Blanchard. John is the dean of the School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast, and Charla is brand new, coming to us from Utah, and going to be sort of anchoring down the human resources management component of the School of Management out there. Hi, Charla.
Hello.
Charlie, say that again.
Hello.
Perfect. See, if I turn your mic on, then you're much clearer. And hi, John.
Hi, Pat.
Yeah. So, tell us about. Give me a kind of a sense of the School of Management's place in the University of Alaska Southeast.
Sure. The School of Management is a evolving into much an adult delivered distance ed program. We offer a full array of degrees from a 1-year certificate, associate degree, 4-year degree, and graduate level degrees in public administration. We're finding that our population of students are primarily adults, non-traditional learners. Large number of these people have full-time jobs, so they're taking courses part-time, most part to improve their skills, but also to be eligible and trained for opportunities to move upward within their given profession. We find there's just a general statistic, there's a graying out of the workforce, tremendous opportunities for mid-level executives, managers to move up in career paths. They see the opportunities are coming at them. Majority, over 70% of our students are female. Not quite sure where all the males are, but the females are coming on strong, and they're taking charge, and they're very aggressive. They work hard. They're incredible dynamic to work with. We have a full array of curriculum. Accounting is by far most popular, but also we have management, marketing, finance, entrepreneurship, and one of our anchor programs and probably second most popular after accounting is in human resource management. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited today, the opportunity to introduce Dr. Charla Brown, a recent recruit, just joined the staff. Family is literally getting on the boat to join her next week. And to really anchor a program that we think is highly valuable to all organizations, whether public or private, and that's in the human resource management area.
And Charlie, you're bringing a kind of an interesting degree into this mixture. Your degree is not in business. It's in psychology, a branch of
my
psychology?
My PhD is in applied social psychology.
Okay.
My master's is in industrial organizational psychology.
Okay. So these are kinds of the roots of what we know now as human resources management. I think years ago this was an emphasis more on things like how you evaluated people and that sort of thing, but that's evolving into a much different discipline, I think, nowadays.
Right. It's about organizational effectiveness and how you motivate your employees, how you manage their performance, and how you really drive not only organizational commitment, but also that bottom line for your executives.
So now, you've been teaching in Utah at a small school down there.
Westminster. It's a private school.
Was this were you teaching in a business program there?
Mm-hmm. I was in the business school.
How did the students respond to this? Coming in, I have a feeling that they might not have expected to have a psychology professor standing in front of them.
It really wasn't a point of focus given my practical background in corporate America. I worked for several Fortune 500 companies, Continental Airlines, Enron. I was also at a startup, Backcountry.com, which is a local success story in Park City. We grew from 100 to 1,000 employees in 4 years, and I could entertain my students for hours with the stories of the things I've encountered both at the executive suite and just day-to-day activity. So, yeah, the psychology really wasn't an emphasis. It was more around kind of my background and my experiences.
How many students are in this particular emphasis? Do you have a count?
In the human resource management,
yeah.
I think we have about 42 declared majors towards a degree.
And this is an emphasis area. The degree will be a bachelor's in business.
Right. The degree is the bachelor's of business administration, and then we have a number of emphasis areas where they would specialize in certain curriculum and coursework. Accounting might be 120 majors. HR, M is about 42 and growing. And It's been a challenge. We've been managing the program with adjuncts who do an excellent job, but to have one with significant years of experience that can apply that experience into the classroom and the dynamic, help us connect with local employers, government, private sector around the state, highly important to us.
So I think your resume really fits that particular model because when someone has been doing the job and now they're increasing their education and training, it really makes a huge difference if the person on the other end of the lessons is experienced in some of the same places.
I agree.
Yeah. Now, I guess one of the questions would be, in your classroom presentation and in the discussions that you get to, how do you avoid or do you take advantage of? What do you do about the competitive spirit that would arise if someone thought maybe they knew a little more about this stuff than you do?
Well, the approach I take in the classroom, every semester I say this right up front. In fact, I've already communicated it to my students that I'm having that start next week. I believe we all can learn something from each other. And so not only can they learn from me, but I know that I can learn from them. I come from a background of teaching adult students where they are professionally engaged, and I love to hear about their experiences, their stories, and I actually design project-based assignments that allow them to demonstrate competency of certain skills using even the environment that they're in. So I haven't really had a run-in with anybody.
I guess maybe run-in is a little bit strong, but I could see a situation arising where someone who had been in HR for a while might, take you on or something like that, in which case it sounds like you have a good strategy for controlling it. By just saying, hey, we can all dip into the pot here.
Well, and what's interesting about HR is every company is different. Every HR department has a different reputation, different kind of they're all at different stages in their evolution to become perhaps a strategic partner. And that's really my goal is to emphasize to students that you can take the skill set and honestly, the sky's the limit. I have reported directly to CEOs. I've demanded a seat at the executive table, and I have been part of senior management teams in this role as I have progressed throughout my career. And that is an opportunity that I think exists for anyone who does pursue human resources management as a field.
With your background, you could have gone a lot of different places. What attracted you to Juno?
What attracted me to Juno? Well, I'm always up for an adventure, and I love the environment. I love the constantly changing weather. I love the people that I've encountered so far. My colleagues at UAS are just over the top in terms of being interpersonally welcoming and friendly and giving. And I've only been here 2 weeks, but so far I've been really impressed.
Outstanding. Well, John, it sounds like you've really increased your abilities to deliver a really powerful component to the program up there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You know, technology has just allowed us the ease of access. The bandwidth across the state has improved, even in the remote distance communities. The style of working and teaching, interacting with students is becoming more and more seamless over time as different ways of video conferencing, even the students' familiarity of using the Internet, communicate via Skype and those different medias that we have. The workforce across the state is becoming more savvy. The students are becoming more savvy. They're bringing in a skill set that's higher than you would have anticipated even 5 years ago. And it just allows for the level of discussion to go to another level. And, you know, what's great about working in Alaska, there's need, there's projects, there's very cool things happening in every community. So there's any number of ways to apply the curriculum to the community and localize it for the student, let them bring their projects to the table to discuss. We're very aggressive in building teams with students that work together. They work together collaboratively, even though they may live thousands of miles apart on a common project. We share that. We're moving more to a case analysis approach on a lot of our students with a lot of the projects. We hope, particularly at the graduate level, to get to a point where we can publish some of these case studies and make it available, because the lessons learned in one community can be applied to the next community as well. So it's a very aggressive, very applied, practical application, working with, you know, sensational group of students and outstanding faculty. We're really excited.
Charlotte Brown, welcome to Juno.
Thank you.
And John Blanchard, thanks for bringing Charlotte down to us and for telling us a little bit about the School of Management. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat.
A reminder to Capital Transit and Caravan passengers. Buses and vans will not be operating on Monday, September 2nd, in recognition of the Labor Day holiday. Full service will resume on Tuesday, September 3rd. The contact number for Capital Transit is 789-6901, and Caravan is 463-6194. With the kids back in school, get them a Capital Transit Youth Pass. Unlimited rides all month for only $12. This message is brought to you by Capital Transit and Caravan.
This is Bird Note. Here they come. Kindergartners are entering the woods to learn about birds. Coordinator Lori O'Brien at the Max Welton Outdoor Classroom on Washington's Whidbey Island welcomes them.
Let's gather around a little bit closer. Put your bodies in slow motion. And what we're going to do is put our heel first and roll our foot. And what we're going to do is walk up the trail together like a fox. Turn your head like an owl does and look around you. What do you see, and what does it make you wonder?
A volunteer helps them learn.
How do they know which materials to use for the kind of nest they're going to build?
Because they just see the materials.
They do, but there's something, a scientific term, that people use for how birds know how to build nests. And it's called instinct. Why do they want a bowl shape in the nest, do you think?
Because of the egg.
What would happen if it were just a flat nest?
The egg would roll out, and they would fall, and they would crack, and then the baby would just be out.
Here, Superintendent of Schools Dr. Joe Mocha says,
well, it's really critical for our students to be able to get outside into a practical application of what they're learning in their classroom. And so the outdoor classroom that the South Whidbey School District has is a perfect location. And it's cared for by the Whidbey Watersheds Group, and it's really a win-win for our community.
Volunteering in outdoor education can be fun. Find out more at birdnote.org.
It's 18 minutes and 30 seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is Marcia Skuritsovskaya, and she is here to talk about a project that I guess began on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro a few years
back. That's correct,
Pat.
Yes.
So can you give me bring us up to speed on this? What's up?
Well, in 2008, I was climbing Mount Kilimanjaro and afterwards went on a safari where I met an African guide that a few months later sent me an email asking me to help him build a school in his village. I told him that I'm not ready to contribute money to such a project, but he said he doesn't need money, he just doesn't know where to start. So what followed was a post on Facebook asking my friends if they know anything about building schools in Africa. And 3 years later, in 2011, I finally decided to take a plunge because I couldn't find anybody else to take this project on.
So no responses to the to the Facebook thing?
I got a lot of people referred me to the book called Three Cups of Tea.
Yes.
So I read that and I decided that if somebody who climbed K2 and was an ER nurse was able to raise money to build a school in Pakistan, I was working for the World Bank, so I should definitely be ahead of the game with that. And so that's where we started. I did a lot of reading. I spoke with a lot of people and finally decided that we can't attract any funding until we had some skin in the game. So Gaspar contributed a plot of land that his family owned in the village.
Gaspar is your...
Yes, Gaspar is the gentleman in Tanzania, the guide. And I had some money that I stashed away that I was planning to spend on a year off work. I was going to travel around the world, but decided this was a much better way to contribute it.
So with that seed money, then, you started raising funds. What?
We actually used the money to build the first building in the school.
Oh, okay.
So the school...
Now, where is this in Africa?
This is in northern Tanzania,
okay.
Which is... Sub-Saharan East Africa. It is about 40 miles south of Mount Kilimanjaro.
Okay.
And the village is located on the slopes of Mount Meru, which is the second tallest mountain in Tanzania, I believe, and the fourth tallest in Africa.
How many people live there?
In the village?
Yeah.
In Midawi? We looked, there's about close to 6,000 people that are actually in our catchment area, but
okay.
They're all spread out across. And the village itself is about 2,000 that is within the borders. There's no zip codes or very good census in Tanzania. So
how many students would be in the school?
So right now we have 38.
Okay.
And we are planning to have up to 300 once we build out the full program. It is boys and girls, yes.
Okay, and there's in this region of Africa, is there a strong bias against females attending school?
It's not a strong bias against females per se, but families see that investing in a boy's education is far more valuable.
Mm.
So right now, our ratio is probably 40% girls, 60% boys. And the way we're trying to remedy this is any donor funds that we receive, and also our goal is to have up to 20% of our students on a pro bono basis. So those scholarships are allocated to girls.
So, Marcia, what is there a goal to that you're attempting to raise to? Is there a number you're trying to hit?
Yes. Yeah, so what happened is when we opened our doors this January, our objective was to have maybe 15 students and one teacher. What ended up happening is we ended up with three times as many students that were coming.
And still one teacher?
we now have three teachers.
Okay.
But the building that we built only had four classrooms. So we are going to hit against our capacity 2 years ahead of time. So the money that we're raising right now is to build a second classroom building.
Okay. And this, what methods are you using? I know there's a bike ride involved in this.
Yes. So we decided, actually, it was a friend of mine that was coming from yet another adventure somewhere on the other side of the world, and he wasn't ready to settle down and look for a real job. So he helped me move to Alaska 2 years ago when I drove across country. And he always wanted to come back and actually retrace his steps on the bicycle. So he said, I would like to do this and help you raise money for your school. So basically, he has been riding across the country on his bicycle with stickers and posters and logos all over him and telling everybody who would listen about our school and about our project. We tied his ride to an Indiegogo campaign that helped us raise, the Indiegogo itself came in at about 4,000, but we got a lot of pledges outside of that.
Yeah, Indiegogo is kind of like, the other one I think is
Kickstarter.
A lot of people know about.
Yes.
So how is Indiegogo different, or?
It's different in a way that even if you don't hit your goal, it allows you to keep the funds.
Okay, yeah.
So which...
a major advantage, yeah.
It is a major advantage, especially to novices like us, where none of us really have a nonprofit background. So we're pretty much figuring out as we go.
What's the guy's name that's riding the bike again?
Sergei Rudyak.
Sergei.
Yes.
Now, Sergei's message basically is pledge money to the school, go to Indiegogo, and do it online?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we're grassroots, and so it takes a village to raise a child, and we're one big global village.
Okay. So where is Sergei right now?
He's in Seattle.
Okay.
He's in Seattle. He's planning to ride through the islands and that way kind of circumvent his way back to Bellingham, where he's going to hop on the ferry, and he's riding into town on...
Into Juneau, yes,
on September 9th or 10th. Whenever the
different ferry docks, right?
Yes,
okay.
And we're going to have a final stop benefit at Rockwell on September 14th, Saturday.
Okay.
It's going to start at 7:30, and that will be the official end of his ride, and also our introduction to Juneau.
Okay, and so is there a charge for this event on September 14th, or are you just putting a bucket by the door?
We're basically putting the bucket by the door, and we have a whole bunch of raffle tickets. We have some great prizes that got donated to us.
Okay.
So we'll be raffling those off. The top prize is a one-week stay in a condo in Cabo San Lucas.
Huh.
So it's actually that's a pretty attractive
deal.
That's a reasonable-looking
prize.
Yes, and Alaska Air flies there. Mm-hmm. So... from Seattle, so it's going to be great, and we have a lot of other smaller ones. And then Tramrec is going to perform for us, and Rockwell has generously agreed to donate a portion of the night's proceeds to our cause.
This is from a woman who has no idea how to raise money. You're getting better at it, aren't you?
Well, we're learning. It's a steep learning curve, but what we found is that it's a lot easier to do it when you have a chance to speak with people face to face, because we're talking about something that we feel very passionate about. So I think that translates into whoever is speaking with you.
Now, your life changed a little bit because of the Kilimanjaro trip, didn't it? Aren't you now partnered with someone?
No, actually, Gaspar has a wife and four kids.
No. I mean, you said that you were that your partner was someone that you had met while you were on that trip. I thought.
No. Gaspar is purely
Gaspar,
a business partner.
You meant partner in business terms.
Yes.
See. Okay.
Yes.
I didn't quite understand the reference there. Okay. Good. Well, I guess the question is, if somebody doesn't want to wait until September 14th and feels moved to do something in response to this broadcast, what should they do?
Well, they can go to our webpage, which is www.ikirwa.org.
I-K-I-R-W-A.
Yes.
Okay.
And there will be a link there to various ways to donate to us. You can donate via PayPal, or you can go via Indiegogo and get one of the perks that we have offered.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you didn't manage to get into the Pick, Click, Give sequence, because I think that goes down sometime in the very near future, right? You're not on there.
No. I'm still coming up the curve.
Okay.
Still coming up the curve. So,
okay.
And you can also find us on Facebook, and we post a lot of updates and a lot of things that are going on with our project. And if you can't afford to help us with financially, we are actually always looking for volunteers. There's only two of us in Juneau, myself and another board member, Julie Hamilton, who unfortunately couldn't join us today. And we could always use another pair of hands to help us. We're also always looking for volunteers to help us with the school itself. That is, it's not just about fundraising, it's about education. And Juneau teachers so far have been wonderful. They have provided a lot of help last year. Providing training. We did video lessons for our staff in Tanzania on how to set up your classrooms and the first-year objectives. They have recommended teaching materials, and we're really hoping that at some point we can find some of the teachers here that would like to go and spend some time in Tanzania. I think they would be a great resource to the school.
A most interesting possibility. Marcia Skuratovskaya, thank you so much. September 14th at Rockwell is the kickoff kind of for local fundraising, and that's when Sergei will be here on his bicycle, and the big party will be to kind of welcome him to town. Thanks a lot for telling us about this.
Thank you.
Sounds like a really exciting project.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, August 30th, 2013. It's the birthday of Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, born Mary Godwin in London, England, 1797. She is the author of Frankenstein, which is considered the first science fiction novel ever written. After her marriage to the poet Shelley, the couple went to stay in a lakeside cottage in Switzerland with the poet Lord Byron. One rainy night, after reading a German book of ghost stories, Byron suggested that they all write down their own horror stories. Everyone else wrote a story within the next day, but Mary took almost a week. Finally, she wrote an early version of a story about a scientist who brings a dead body to life. She turned the story into a novel, and Frankenstein was published in 1818. She was 21 years old. It's the birthday of cartoonist Robert Crumb, or R. Crumb, born in Philadelphia in 1943. When he was a kid, he and his brother produced hundreds of comic books about a character they invented named Fritz the Cat. He got a job with the American Greetings Corporation, drawing funny pictures for cards. His boss was always telling him that his pictures were too grotesque and he had to make them cuter. So in the late 1960s, Crumb moved to San Francisco and began illustrating rock concert posters and album covers, and one of the pictures he drew popularized the phrase, "Keep on truckin'." He began publishing comic books, and he sold his own books out of a baby carriage in Haight-Ashbury. His were among the first so-called underground comics aimed at adults rather than children, which addressed sex, racism, absurdity, and alienation, and featured characters such as Mr. Natural and Schumann the Human. For most of his life, Crumb has worn a fedora hat and business suits from the 1930s. He listens only to old blues and jazz records, only watches black and white television. A friend of his said, "He is like a kid whose parents had locked him in an attic full of old records and magazines. His taste in everything comes from a time when he did not exist." After his success, Crumb sold a stack of his original sketchbooks in exchange for a chateau in the French countryside, where he continues to live and work. It's the birthday of Warren Buffett, born in Omaha, Nebraska, in 1930. In February of 2008, he was ranked by Forbes as the richest person in the world, worth about $62 billion. Despite his massive wealth, he lives relatively frugally, resides in the home he bought in 1958 for $31,000, and drives his own car. In 2006, he announced his plans to give 83% of his fortune to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And here's a poem by Connie Wanick titled Summer Night. The street lamp looks down. It has dropped something and spends the whole night searching around its feet. The rumble of a jet and the fast road blocks away, roaring like a cataract. The scent of mown grass and of the body that mowed it. The sidewalk made of warm squares heaved by maple roots, covered with hieroglyphics in chalk. A maple sapling, its trunk wrapped to the knee like the legs of a racehorse galloping straight up. At dawn, the prodigal son returns, accompanied by equatorial birds and a floral entourage. What good has it done us to labor so when all are rewarded? Let the spade fall then and join the feast. Summer Night, a poem by Connie Wanick from her collection Hartley Field, published by Holy Cow Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us here next time.
just coming up on 25 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is one of the family support specialists with an organization called the Alaska Center for Resource Families. John Bennett is here. And, John, I understand that we're going to talk a little bit about Juneau's need for foster parents.
Yes, that's right.
So, can you explain just a little bit about what the Alaska Center for Resources Families is?
Yes, the Alaska Center for Resource Families is a private nonprofit that contracts with the Office of Children's Services to provide training and support to foster, guardianship, and adoptive families throughout the state of Alaska. I'm the sole person working in Juneau, but we have offices in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Wasilla.
Can you give me an idea of the scope of the problem in Alaska?
Yes. The scope.
Or in Juneau.
I'm frequently asked, people frequently say to me, oh, I hear that there's a need for foster parents. Is that real? Is there a real shortage of foster parents? And it's kind of difficult to explain. It's not as though there are children who are put out on the street or back with their abusive parents because there's not a home for them. But sometimes children who come into the state's custody are placed very temporarily with one family who can take them for a couple of weeks but doesn't want a long-term commitment, and then they get bounced from one home to another. Some kids do better in a home where they're the only child. Some kids do better in a home where there are other children, but there's not always that ideal home to place a child with. And so what the Office of Children's Services wants to do is have an ideal placement for a child, or as near to ideal as possible. Every time a child is moved from one home to another, that's harmful to the child. So yes, if a child comes into custody, we're going to find a home for them. But the more homes that are out there, the easier it's going to be for OCS to find the one placement that child's going to be in, rather than several.
And part of the job, or I guess the biggest part of the job for Alaska Center for Resource Families, is to provide those homes? Are you actually the one who brings them to the Office of Children's Services?
No. The Office of Children's Services are the ones that do that. What we our job is primarily education. Children who come into the state's custody are considered to be children with special needs. They are the children really of abuse and neglect. A lot of times there are children who've had prenatal exposure to alcohol. Almost always there's been some sort of abuse or neglect in the home, which is what has prompted the Office of Children's Services to remove them from that home. So those children come with a certain amount of emotional issues that they're dealing with, and it's important that the families that take them in understand those issues. If you try to raise a child, let's say, who has had prenatal exposure to alcohol, if you try to raise that child like you raise the two or three kids that you raised from birth, you're going to run into some dead ends because those children, they process things differently. And the more you understand about how they process things differently, the easier your job will be, and the easier their job will be, or their life will be. The same is true of early childhood trauma and attachment disorders that affect a lot of the kids in care. So it's important that parents have some understanding of the realities of raising children with special needs. And so that's what we do, is that training. When new families come to the Office of Children's Services, they usually send them straight to me, and I put them through an orientation. I put them through makes it sound worse than it is. The orientation is pretty painless, actually. It's about an hour, and we offer them a couple of times a month. And the purpose of orientation is to get the parents' questions answered and to make sure that there are certain things that the Office of Children's Services, which I'm going to start referring to as OCS, it's sure. just easier, mm-hmm. That there are certain things that OCS wants to be sure that those families understand before they embark on this journey. And we cover that in orientation. And I give those people forms to fill out and get them on the path towards becoming foster parents.
This is a terrific responsibility because you're really, I didn't realize this, but your organization is really the front line for preparing a foster family to receive foster children. How did you come to this position?
Well, the Alaska Center for Resource Families is a program of Northwest Resource Associates, which is a Seattle-based nonprofit, and they have programs in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for 10.5 years in the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center. And so when I came here to Juneau, I had been working in the field for 10.5 years. Mostly we were working with adoptive families in Portland. But there's a lot of crossover. I mean, there's a lot of the same things that apply. We're still dealing with the same population of kids, essentially. I got into it, I guess, because my cousin was the person who was the head of this organization, she said they had an opening for families, or for this, when the Alaska, or the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center came into being, she let me know about it. And I had had a background working with children who were in a residential treatment center before. So I've done some working with those kinds of kids before. I'm a former high school English teacher, actually.
How do the when foster parents are referred to you by OCS and you do the orientation with them, are they surprised by what you show them, what you tell them?
That's a good question. Most of them don't show a lot of surprise. Some do. Sometimes the families that come to us have a specific child in mind, and usually that's a relative. So they usually are somewhat familiar with the issues that kid's dealing with, and are less surprised, or else maybe think that some of the things I'm talking about aren't going to apply to that kid because he's family. And sometimes some of the things I'm talking about won't apply to that kid because he's family. I think by and large, people come into it knowing that there's a lot to learn. And so they may be learning things they didn't know, but I don't know that they're particularly surprised by it.
Maybe grateful to have somebody finally open up the book a little bit.
I think so. I think when they get out of orientation, I'm guessing that most people feel a certain sense of relief. A, they know that they're on the right path now. Now they know what they have to do to make the next move and the next move. And I think they also feel like they have a certain understanding of what this journey is going to demand of them.
Would someone come to you before they involved themselves with OCS?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
If someone wanted to do that, how would they reach you?
I would encourage them to do that. Well, they can call me.
Okay.
My phone number is 907-790-4246.
Okay.
And that's the best way. I can give you my email address, but it's better to call, I think.
Okay. So you encourage people that are that have questions about foster children and maybe in a situation where they're thinking we got to do something about this kid to contact you, and you can help them
toward the
path that gets them through the process.
If they call OCS, the chances are OCS will just refer them to me. If they haven't done anything yet, the first thing that OCS will want them to do is talk to me and go through that process. And a lot of times people call me, they haven't had the orientation, but they've got a lot of questions, and I'll answer those questions on the phone, or people drop in sometimes.
Okay. John, the telephone number, if you have questions about these, this really important program run by the Alaska Center for Resource Families, the family support specialist is John Burton. And he, John Bennett. And his telephone number is 907-790-4246. John, thank you so much for letting us know a little bit about the program.
Thank you for having me on, Pat.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I love KTOO. All these wonderfully entertaining things that I listen to while I paint.
That's Juno artist Constance Baltuck, who has generously donated her painting, Waterfall Salmon Creek, as a 40th anniversary fundraising gift for KTOO. We're offering a limited edition of 200 prints signed and numbered by the artist. All proceeds benefit KTOO. To learn more, visit kto.org/anniversary.
Bailey is a phenomenal cellist, artist, person, communicator, and what can I say, a ambassador for classical music.
Jazz and Classics artistic and executive director Linda Rosenthal says cellist Zuhl Bailey is stopping in Juneau on his way from Sitka to Anchorage. Known for speaking directly to the audience, Bailey shares his craft through storytelling.
And when this cello was 27, Bach decided to take essentially a piece of furniture and write the greatest works.
That's Bailey on NPR's Tiny Desk Concert, introducing Bach's Prelude No. 1. He says the commentary enhances the experience, giving audience members new insight on the music hundreds of years old. The stories range from personal experiences to the composer's location when the piece was written and what was happening in the world at that time.
They're always human in nature. It's never, you know, theoretical stuff. It's friendships and love affairs and enemies and death. These kinds of things inspire why we feel innately this music if we were to hear it. And the classical music is such a boutique experience and timeless experience. And what's so wonderful about classical music is that they can kind of stick their toe into the pool of sounds. And then you want to hear it again and again and again, because hence the word classic, the classics. They are so deep and so significant.
Unlike past recitals, Bailey will not feature a single composer, but many, some born in America and some who fled Europe and made a life in the United States. Playing the music of Barber and Bernstein, pianist Laura Downs will accompany Bailey and perform a half recital, featuring composers exiled to the United States. The two are getting ready to record an album of American music that should be all over the map. Rosenthal says she's excited by Down's addition.
I feel, too, that with Zuhl, any program he chooses or any piece of music he chooses will never, ever disappoint an audience. I mean, people just seem to be tremendously inspired, uplifted, energized by his performances, always.
Zuhl Bailey and Laura Downs will be performing Made in America this Sunday at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. Tickets can be purchased at Hearthside Books, the Jack Box Office, and at the door. In Juneau, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
It's about 12 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Our next guest comes to us not by the studio, but by telephone. My next guest is actually in Bellingham, Washington, sitting with the telephone pressed up against his ear. And Cullen is involved in an extremely interesting project down in Bellingham. He is operating a library, but it's an alternative library. Cullen, could you tell us a bit about what the differences are between yours and, say, the Bellingham Public Library?
Yeah. I think the main difference is that our library is entirely run by our members, which is an entirely open invitation kind of system to become a member. But essentially, the people who are involved in it and who are checking out books have the ability to interface with us and tell us exactly what they want.
So, Cullen, this is more like on the model of like a food co-op or something like that.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah, we consider ourselves a cooperative, and you know, anyone. Basically, the members are owners of the library as well.
I'm wondering why the public library system in most communities serves most of the needs, and I'm wondering what it is that you, where the niche is. Why are you in here?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we have a kind of a few focus points that we, that our collection kind of revolves around, that I think it's a lot easier for folks to engage with sort of radical culture and art books through our library, just because we've made that sort of a specific focus from the beginning. And so we have just a much broader array of books on those particular subjects. Yeah, I'm not really sure how else to state that, but...
Well, when I was looking at your webpage, I noticed that you have quite an emphasis on music and youth.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
I mean, we've noticed that that we've gotten a lot of young people who are really interested, who are kind of searching for something something to identify with, and have found our space because we present a lot of ideas that aren't really found amongst mainstream media. And so there's a lot of young people who have really been drawn to our space, and we have in where we currently are located, there's also a bunch of music studios around, and a lot of our community is very involved in the local music scene and art scene as well.
I think one of the differences that I noticed about the website is as you click through it, you find yourself on a section called forums.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not used to a library having a set of forums as part of its component.
Yeah. I mean, the main reason for this is we're trying to basically make it transparent as to how the library is being run, so that people who aren't involved in the meetings that are where the decisions are being made can still kind of see what's being talked about and can feel a part of it even if they can't make it to a particular meeting. And we can also kind of try to elicit responses from our membership through that and have discussions about whatever we're engaging with through the library.
How many members does your library have at this point?
I'd say we're right around 700. But, I mean, that's a number of people that are kind of in our system, but as you can imagine, it's a smaller fraction of that uses the library with it very regularly.
Are you keeping track of circulation figures?
Gosh, you know, I know we are. That's actually the guy who does all of our web programming for this website keeps track of a lot of numbers. But I don't have access to all of it right now. We actually don't have our homepage usually says how many books we have and how many times we've had items checked out, but right now we have our homepage is we're running a fundraising drive.
Well, I understand you are running a fundraising drive, and this is because you're about to move into new quarters?
That's right. We've been around for about 6 years, and about a year ago we moved to downtown Bellingham just to kind of experiment with it and see how the community responded to it and see, you know, how it changed the way we ran. And it's turned out to be very, very successful to the point where we need to get massively upgrade our space to be able to continue running the kind of organization that we want to.
So have you managed to find a facility that will massively upgrade your space?
Yeah, we're about to move into a space that's about 10 times the size where we'll be able to do a lot more. We'll be able to continue with what we're doing as well as take on a lot of new projects that are in mind and kind of expand upon the concept of the library.
What's been the reaction from the Bellingham Library?
The public library?
Yeah.
They're pretty excited about what we're doing. The few librarians that I've talked to who have come into our space have been really into it. and, you know, don't feel threatened by it at all. I mean, it's not, we're not really looking to compete with them. We're looking to kind of do something that's a little bit different. I mean, a large part of our space is also that we're kind of we can be a meeting place for a particular kind of and an event space for things that the public library might not want to host.
Now, you said that you have to be a member in order to participate in the, you have to actually pay dues in order to participate in the discussions, but can other people use the library on some basis who are
not members? I mean, anyone is welcome in our space during our open hours, but the basically what membership involves, or like what you get with being a member, is you then have the ability to vote on and choose which books that we buy for our collection, and suggest books to be voted on by other members. We have basically a forum on our website where all this is decided on. And so that's like, I think that's the main perk of membership, and also, you know, the ability to check out books, of course. You know, we only check out books to people who are members of the library.
So I'm looking through the minutes of the August, let's see, this is the August 15th, 2013 meeting.
Mm-hmm.
they're written by someone with obviously a sense of humor.
I haven't read the notes from this meeting, but
it closing, it says millions of dollars, and then that's repeated.
Eight times. We usually have a closing ritual where we all shout, "I love the library," but being that we're doing a fundraiser right now, we decided to do a millions of dollars chant. So.
Well, this really, it sounds, the other aspect of the website, which I was quite delighted with, was you have a YouTube clip in the middle of the thing, and it's basically your patrons talking about how they feel about the library.
Yeah, this was just done in a day.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound like your mother's library. I mean, this is a group of people who obviously have found a kind of a second home here.
Yeah. And that's kind of something that we're trying to do, that we've always tried to do, but especially that we're very excited about in our new space, is kind of creating like a living room style space in the middle of downtown that's very open, and people can feel welcome to just come in and hang out and not feel obligated to buy anything.
Historically, you fall into an interesting category. Thomas Jefferson, I guess, originally started a library which was on this same kind of basis?
Yeah. You know, I didn't actually know about it at the time, but, you know, in doing some research and kind of becoming a U.S. history nut in over the course of the years of running the library, I found out that Thomas Jefferson started the first libraries, and they actually ran pretty much exactly like our library, which, you know, in coming up with the concept for it, it was just kind of, it just seemed to be what I thought was the better system. And it's cool to find out that, you know, that Thomas Jefferson, who's a politician who I really have a lot of respect for, a lot of what he has written and accomplished, came up with basically the same idea.
Cullen, I wish you very good luck with your project, and I hope you were able to raise millions of dollars for the move into the new facility, and it sounds like you're going to put it to good use when you get there.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for telling us about the Bellingham Alternative Library. So you're tuned with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This has been Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your very willing host today, had a wonderful time doing it. Monday, KTOO is going to use the Juneau Afternoon time slot for a special Intelligence Squared debate on the situation in Syria. So tune in to that on Monday, a special Intelligence Squared debate on the situation in Syria. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, it's K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9 MHz. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. Our sister stations, KRNN, is on 872 and KXLL on 873. And we stream continuously online at www.ktoo.org, including Juneau Afternoon. Shortly after this program, the stream will be up and the archive will be up as well.